Welcome to The Author's Tale, brought to you by Edition Audiobooks. The Author's Tale is a series of casual conversations with prominent and influential New Zealand authors who have made their mark in New Zealand and overseas. They have often gone under the radar in their home country, but have contributed to New Zealand's cultural history in a way that if they were musicians, would be considered rock stars of their genre. They are the word stars of New Zealand literature. Not wanting to focus on a particular book or work, I'm more interested in speaking with the author in their own surroundings and getting an idea of where they have come from and what has influenced their journey to date. We meet, where possible, in their homes, not in a studio, so you may hear others moving around or pets coming to say hi. We drink coffee or tea and eat fruitcake made using my mother's recipe. She was the person who encouraged my love of a good book and great writing, so it seems fitting to include her.
I am driving on a road around the coast of Christchurch. People forget that Christchurch is actually right beside the ocean, and a number of our suburbs are actually seaside suburbs. And this morning I'm making my way to Sumner, which is where my author lives. But this road I'm currently going along at some absolute snail's pace, because since our earthquakes that we had, 10, 11 years ago, the road has undergone several refurbs, dig-ups, redos, etc., etc., widenings, and oh my goodness, and here we go again. So with a bit of luck, I've managed to get here when the road has been open this morning for 10 minutes, so I can actually get through to Sumner. But when you get to Sumner, it's a great spot. Beautiful beach, lovely in summertime to come with your dogs and family, and lots of surfers, very popular for surfers here, but I mean at the moment we are in the middle of winter and there's not a lot of surfing being done today. It's pretty bleak out there. There's a huge container ship out there though in the ocean, and this cliff face on the right hand side as I'm heading towards Sumner is one that crumbled in our earthquakes, and it's covered in wire netting. It's actually quite fascinating to look at, especially now I'm getting slow enough I can actually have a decent look at it. You wouldn't want to be underneath it if there was another rumble, but yeah. Sumner, when you get here, it's lovely. So if you haven't been here before, I highly recommend you make the effort to come. Beautiful seaside village. Anyway, I'm meeting today with my author. Now I've got to find her. So I better keep my eyes on the road.
I'm Stephanie Fruin, and this is the first episode of my talk with Christchurch-based award-winning writer Heather McQuillan. She writes children's, young adult, short stories and flash fiction. I met Heather a number of years ago when we both worked as creative writing teachers for the School for Young Writers in Christchurch. It is now called the Write On School for Young Writers, and Heather is its director. When I first arrived to chat with Heather, she takes me up a wonderful spiral staircase to her writing room, bit of a secret spot, and this is absolutely delightful. I just love it when I get to see where the genius is created.
A lot of noise as you walk up, but I call it my early warning system if anybody's coming to
inquire. Have they always been there, or did
they
so you didn't pop it in as like, oh, I need a little knock at the top of a stairway?
No, it was when we came and looked and I saw that. I went, it's an odd, look, you can see the odd layout up here. It's not
conventional.
But this was.
Do you know what? I always think. Do you know what they always remind me of? No, you won't. Oh, listen to it.
So I've just incorporated the into a story.
Brilliant. Oh, brilliant. Oh, and look, we've got the books lining up at the top of the stairs.
We've run out of shelves.
Look at that. Oh, that's an old copy of Dune.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Might even be, an original Dune.
Wow.
Yeah, I reread them just before
my son loves
saw the movie.
Yeah, and God, he's watched the movie a gazillion times. Look at this.
It's not an original.
What a little nook up here for you.
Yeah, so. Oh. From this window, on a good day, I can see the Alps.
Yeah.
And then I have the ocean. So this, as you can see, this.
Yeah.
So here's the lovely thing. I've had this old desk with this leather top for quite a long time.
Yeah.
When we came.
How the hell did you get it up
and
we here? Looked,
and there was no way it was going to get up here.
No.
And I just said, look, I've loved it. It's old. It can go. We'll sell it.
Oh.
And I came home one day, and I think Barry had a bit of a grin on his face. And there was a bit of a rope out here somewhere. And I came up, and here it was. He took it apart, hoisted.
Yeah.
Yeah. With some help. And yes. Over the balcony. And
what a wonderful.
So it's never leaving
one.
Here.
No. What a wonderful surprise to come home to. But what a great spot.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a shambles.
Oh, but no, you reckon? I'm looking how tidy it is.
Shambolic.
Good Lord. And no wonder you.
So I have this is my standing desk, my improvised standing desk.
Oh, golly.
Here.
See, I don't know. Oh, aren't you amazing?
That's my sitting desk. Yeah. And then I say, that's my lying down desk. So
time to lie back and just think about.
It's editing.
Good on you. And do you have a wee sign on this that says nobody else?
Oh no, there's allowed. Nobody knows. No. My grandson absolutely loves it.
I bet.
He's discovered.
I half expect to see a pile of Lego under.
He's discovered the danger zone. This is the danger zone.
Yes,
because you can get into the roof cavity.
Nooks and crannies.
Secret. So there's also a secret.
Nooks and crannies at home with granny.
Everyone always wanted a secret room.
Yeah,
growing up.
Yeah, totally. All you need now is a dumb waiter down to that kitchen so you can send down a message. Barry, wouldn't mind a coffee or a tea or a whatever thing. Getting a bit peckish. A sandwich would be just lovely. Enough, it would come hoist away. You got a flagpole? No. Look, see, I'd just spend all day long looking at that
balcony.
Yeah. No, it is. It's lovely. It's when you just need that break and you stand up and you just go, look, the ocean is right there. And on a good day, open the door. And
Where oceans meet, almost.
Yes. So you see influences, right?
I definitely see influences. Wow. But this reminds me, you know, when you go to Larnex Castle and you've got to go up the tower.
Well, do you remember the cathedral stairs? Spiral stairs in the.
Do you know what? I don't think I ever went up the cathedral spire. No, I don't think I ever did. I've been up plenty of other cathedral spires around the globe, but I don't think I've ever done the Christchurch one. Well, I think you've got a magical spot out here.
After making our way back down those stairs, we continue our chat in her living room and do our best to ignore the constant drone from the earth-moving vehicle busy shifting dirt on the construction site over the fence.
Anyway, I am just so thrilled to finally get you sitting down for more than 5 minutes. Because, I mean, you and I normally, when our paths cross, it's always been sort of, well, I can't say work-related, I suppose, in a way, but it's always been that dashed 15 minutes before we
get sorted in by stacking up chairs or something like that.
And the funny thing is, Heather, is that I always knew you were a writer, but until I actually sat and focused on you, I didn't really know a huge amount about your writing. Shame on me. So I have loved getting to know you better through your writing. It's been just a delight, actually. This is my assortment here that I've got. And I gathered them together and sort of read. And I guess the thing that has struck me the most is how different each is.
Yeah, that'll be right.
Yeah.
Why isn't the same thing again?
but almost sort of different in style and different in approach. And you know how some people sort of have a sort of particular genre they write for, and you just get a similar-ish kind of thing within that genre, you know, whereas you I feel like you've just gone all over it. And I wonder if that probably reflects your history. And as we were just saying before, about how funny how all things come together, as a teacher, you know, all that experience you've had with children, with, you know, I guess, when, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think? I mean...
Yeah, so when you're saying that, I'm looking at the three young children, the middle grade sort
of novels. I better read out what I've got. Nest of Lies, Mind Over Matter, Avis and the Promise of Dragons, and Where Oceans Meet. Right. So these are the four books that I really focused on. And I guess your...
So the three books for middle grade children, they are all... children around the age that I spent most of my teaching career, so 11 and 12-year-olds.
Yeah.
Though Nest of Lies, they go up to 14. The main character's 14.
And you can tell that, yeah.
But it's really interesting that you say they're very different. Yes, they are in terms of setting and style, and yet I'm very aware, as I've just finished three more middle-grade novels, how similar themes keep coming through for me.
Yeah.
And it's around connecting friendships, very much so, which is a really big deal at that 11, 12-year-old.
It is.
Of which group do I belong in? How do I belong? Where do I belong? What's my identity? I think because I've worked with those children so much, I've got to know them really, really well.
Yeah, exactly. So before we even investigate or any of these, tell us a little bit about what brought you to that point of, tell us about, your own, as a child yourself, did you ever envisage that you would become a writer?
I wanted to be an actor.
Yeah.
That was not a possibility. It was be a teacher or a nurse or a secretary as going through
Was that something that was sort of told to you by your family or was it just
it was the expectation but also
societal.
School. So I went into teaching quite young. I went to Teacher's College at the age of 16.
Which
was at university. And Teacher's Training College.
Oh my lord, that is really young, isn't it?
At the age of 16, which I kind of think people should have told me not to.
but it was done on that day, wasn't it?
It was done. And I was too young. I was under the age requirement. So all through my childhood, books surrounded us.
Yeah.
My mother was a book person.
Yeah. And huge influences, aren't they, parents?
She would buy bundles of books from Whitcalls for 50 cents all wrapped up in brown paper. And it was like Christmas. And we would unpack these books. And I still remember The Six Wives of Henry VIII and Teach Yourself Turkish, I think, was one. I don't think I ever got into that. But it was always a surprise what was in those bundles.
Yeah, it would be like Christmas.
So you were commenting on the books up my staircase and, of course, the books stacking. We run out of bookshelf.
Yeah.
My mother made bookshelves out of apple crates.
Yes.
So our entranceway hallway was stacks. So books.
And how many were in your family?
There were four children.
And where did you land in the
school? I was number two.
Number two.
And we made books. And so I've just been thinking about this because I'm thinking a lot about that idea of children making books as play, as writing as play.
Yes. Yeah.
And the joy of creating this artifact, this book, this thing exists. Where it takes you. And we actually made a book last night with my little 4-year-old grandson.
Yeah.
And the delight in his eyes when he got granddad to read it.
Yeah.
And it said the same thing. And then his dad read it.
Yes.
And he's nodding along that, yes, this is the story. Yeah. And it was such a delight that he had that Nana and Arthur had created this book.
Yeah.
We made books, my sisters and I. And I remember... putting them through my mother's sewing machine, making
bind them up.
And of course, none of them are kept.
Oh, none what a shame.
So that is a shame because I want to talk about bookmaking now with teachers and show them what joy that is for the kids to do. So, and even our teenage writers at the School for Young, Write On School for Young Writers love the chance to make a book.
And there's something really magical, isn't there, about when you create something that it has gone, especially when it comes to something like a book, it's gone from an idea in your head to physically writing on it on a page to then putting your name on the front cover, written by, so you own it, your idea, and then if it needs pictures, someone draws them or you draw them or whatever, and you have this creation at the end of it. Mm. And unless you choose to toss it out or whatever, it's
quite different to publishing online.
Oh, yeah.
So I've had hundreds of pieces are probably online, but I don't physically have them. Whereas the books, the anthologies, they're there. Yes. And so that's part of the idea around what we do for our young writers is publishing the magazine, the Write On magazine. And we've talked and talked around that's an expense, it costs us, we need to seek out funding to do this. But it is our gift to those young writers to
say, is a gift, isn't it?
We value what you've written so much, we want to publish it and we want it to be shared with other people.
Yeah.
And then you see them when they get their magazine.
And their name's in print.
And then that's the first thing they do is to hug it to them. And in the new magazine, there is now a little part at the back so they can find their name and find what page they're on. Yeah. And they hug it to them, and suddenly there we are, it's written. Go. So I think when I said to you I was always going to be an actor, I think that was a storyteller, probably.
Yeah. Because isn't it funny? Because I think the whole thing, because I mean, that was, you know, what I started out doing as well. And it's just the telling of story and the enjoyment you take as an actor, you take someone else's words and you put your own twist on it and you give it to someone else to enjoy someone else's words. And it's just such a fabulous thing to do. And the art of being the storyteller, and that's what you have become.
Mm. So when my oldest son was, and I was home with him and I was telling him stories and bedtime stories, he didn't want to be read to, he wanted stories told.
Oh.
And so I started writing, not writing down the stories I told him, but I thought, well, I could write a story, and I sent it into the school journal, which I did. I think I sent them three stories.
Oh, and the good old New Zealand school journal.
When you could send them, because now it's by commission. Yeah. Oh. And I got a rejection letter. And I really wish I had kept that rejection letter, because I do recall what it said.
Mm-hmm.
And it said that the stories I'd written were not suitable for what they were looking for at the moment, but they liked my writing and would I send them more?
Okay.
Now,
so that's not really a rejection letter, is it?
But when you're a brand new beginner and you've just put your heart and soul into it, I didn't understand that.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, they're just being nice.
Yeah.
Now I know
that
is not a rejection letter.
Yeah.
I didn't then. So I didn't send them anything
else. Because they didn't want what you had sent, therefore they don't want you. That's what you read as that young, new person, don't you? That's what you see and what you read.
So that sort of sits in the back of my mind. That's when I could have maybe written some more and sent some more, and it might have started something else. But that always sat at the back of my mind. Mm. And it wasn't until a long time later, when I actually had teenagers in the house, that I had some time where I was seconded out of the classroom to work as an advisor for the new arts curriculum. And at that time, it was dance and drama were my areas of expertise.
So when when you went to teachers' college at the tender age of 16, which just blows me away, so how did they do it? So you went in, and did you have to focus on a particular area? I mean, how did they sort of guide you into what you were then going to become?
Yeah. Well, it was primary teaching.
So you did everything.
So we did everything, but I specialised in visual art.
Okay.
That was...
You just chose to do that?
Yes, because I was interested. It was English and art were my two.
Yeah, right.
Were my two forties. Yeah. Of course, there was There was no drama or dance in the curriculum back then.
Goodness me. So then, of course, when you left teachers' college and you go into the school system, then I guess you were the visual arts person.
So and I ended up moving down to Southland to get a permanent job.
Oh, so no, that's
so I was in Christchurch.
You were in Christchurch, and then you went to teachers' college, and then you moved down to Southland. Yeah, okay.
And around about that same time that my eldest son was a little one, I got involved in theatre sports.
Great.
Which was storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and improvised storytelling.
Yeah.
And that same stuff I link into the way I write, which is very playful, which is very explorative, which is just write it, see what happens.
Yeah.
What happens next because of this cause and effect.
Yeah.
So... story was the key thing of working in that. And I moved back to Christchurch and took a role at the Court Theatre as their first education officer that they had.
What a great job to get.
Yeah, it didn't pay well, and as a single mum of two little ones, it was, you know, but it was a part-time job, and it was really fascinating. So all those things kind of go together. So when many years later I had this time away out of the classroom, and my brain was a little bit freed up, that's when Mind Over Matter got written. But it was certainly something that had been fermenting for quite a long time.
Yeah, and in the meantime, of course, you'd had all these other experiences which just grow you as a writer, doesn't it? You know, all your, you know, then you've got so much more to draw on.
Yes, and so a lot of that, then by then I was teaching year 7 and 8s, so there were some of their stories, not obviously their stories, but pieces of their stories.
So this was your first ever publication, or had you been published in anything else?
This was it. So I had written this manuscript, and
so this was done in this was published in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'd written it. I went back to my classroom. Oh, so it was.
And you were busy teaching at the time.
I was busy teaching. So when I wrote it, it really did take me over, and I had four teenagers in the house and one computer. So Saturday and Sunday mornings at 4 o'clock was the best time to get up, do a couple of hours, and then try and catch a nap sometime in the afternoon so that I could.
So I'm picturing then that if you were getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to write your book on a Friday and a Saturday, or a Saturday and a Sunday, in this busy house with four teenagers, then it was more than, it took you over. It was more than simply a mild stirring of an idea. Clearly you needed to get the story.
I needed to get that story written.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I had no idea then what to do with it. And it was my school librarian who said, do you know about the Tom Fitzgibbon Award? And gave me a brochure.
Now tell us about the Tom Fitzgibbon Award. So it won it, didn't it?
It won it.
Yeah.
Yeah, which for a first ever manuscript, I do tell people, this was just pure luck that I was there in that time, because that doesn't happen. Usually people who win the Tom Fitzgibbon maybe have written before, and it might be that they're unpublished.
Yeah.
But I hadn't even written anything before.
You had written nothing before, but how these series of events lead you to, and the fact that your librarian, what an angel she was in your path at the time, and said, have you heard of the Tom Fitzgibbon Award? So yeah, explain to us, Tom Fitzgibbon, do you know?
So so it is. It's part of the Storylines Foundation, and it was at that time awarded annually to a manuscript for someone who was unpublished.
Right.
Now it's changed.
Yes.
So it is now open to published and unpublished.
Right.
Yeah. And it has been won this year by an previously unpublished, I think. Yep. Local writer as well. Sorry, I've forgotten her name, and I met her the other day.
Fabulous. That's exciting.
So that is exciting because she was up against published writers.
Yes.
Who were, and I was up against other people who were unpublished.
Yeah.
What happened for me through that was, it wasn't an editing, it was a mentorship.
Yeah.
Because the book needed a lot of restructuring.
Yeah.
It was too long.
Right. So how long was it initially? Because this book...
It's two books. As you will realise, you will see it's in two parts.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And it's this copy is 276 pages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So from memory, I say it was about... I had to take about 20,000 words to 30,000 words out. I may be exaggerating that when I talk to children, I tell them that. But it was at least 6, 7, 8 chapters. It was a whole nother sequence of adventures with a whole nother character who then, because I took that out, I had to restructure the ending because there were differences in things that happened there.
I reckon for a first book, when I read, because I didn't read this first, the first one I read was that.
All right, actually. Which is my most recent,
I guess. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then I went back, and then I think, and then I read this, then I read that, then I read that, then I read that. Anyway, but when I read this, and I thought, what a sophisticated first book. Just, I mean, maybe, I think everything everything about it to me just, it doesn't read like a first book to me. It reads like an experienced writer.
I think it's an experienced reader. So that's where you learn, isn't it?
Wow.
First up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought it was great. I loved it. And, you know, and the thing I thought, and I've written, what have I written down here? I've got my notes about it. Just the other, about different, God, I can't read my writing. That's always the way. Different realities. Yes, but the whole different realities thing. Of course, this is a story about the staff, and it sort of becomes what it needs to be. So explain
to us. Shape-shifting.
Thank you. Explain to us mind over
Ariel
nature.
Comes from another universe where nothing remains solid. You can shift and shape your atoms, your quarks, all those.
Yes.
So you've got mind over matter. Yeah. So
now hang on. Before we got started recording, this is where I love getting into. Now, your husband, you told me, is a maths and physics teacher. So
you better revise that, because he doesn't like the word husband. He's my partner.
Oh, sorry. Your partner is a maths and physics, or retired maths and physics teacher. Now, when I read this, I thought, this writer clearly has a really good knowledge of physics, or did
I didn't know Barry at that time, so it was research. No, I was in another relationship then. I did a lot of research. So when I say I loved dance and drama and language, when I was teaching, for me, science became a thing, because I had to learn it to teach it.
Yeah,
I loved it.
Yeah,
and I was very fascinated by science. So that came through in there.
Totally.
So the first part you will see.
My brain's gone. Even quantum physics.
Quantum physics, thank you.
I'm reading this, you will
see some quantum physics stuff.
Absolutely.
And when you say, I must have researched it, no, I skimmed. Oh my gosh, I skimmed and stole and picked. I couldn't talk to you about it.
Well, it doesn't come
across
my head.
And then the second part
really
is the,
well.
And then the second part is the neuroscience.
Yeah.
Because now that was quite astonishing when I got to that part, and I discovered that the glia cells are shaped like a starfish. And so
I loved all of that.
We'll all be. Yeah.
And I thought this book wasn't ahead of its time, but I could almost imagine today this going really, really well. Yeah.
So I have written the third part. The third act is written. And I got tangled on the science for the ending.
Right.
Maybe one day. Who knows? I've got the rights back. So it is sitting there as a project. Maybe it's a retirement project to put all three parts, all three acts out
together
online or something like that.
Yeah.
I
thought it was really interesting. And so I've got, as you can see, I go through and I and then I have to remind myself, why did I put that marker there? Because as I'm reading along, I have my things beside me, and I go, put a marker in. Now, what does this say? Why did I choose this bit? He was being asked to save the world. Okay,
all 12-year-olds have to save the world, by the way.
Of
I do tell that to students. That
of course
if,
they
if
do.
If you were in a novel, you would need to be saving the world right now.
Yes. Absolutely. Now, yes. Now, Dukali Sue, where did that name come from?
So there are anagrams in some of the names. So, and they're also names from The Tempest.
Ah.
From Shakespeare's Tempest, you will pick up. Because it starts in a storm.
Yes.
And it starts on a dark and stormy night.
Yes.
Not quite in that wording, but it is a storm. And so Caleb Antwerp is Caliban. Anyway, and
Dukali Sue
is Claudia something. I can't remember now.
Gosh, all these little secrets.
They are anagrams. And they're just little secrets. I shouldn't say anything more. But I love
it. You should, because that makes it more appealing to pick it up. And
one reviewer did pick up some references. Said there's obviously references here to The Tempest. Yeah. And of course, obviously, Miranda. I do that. I play little games around the names, and they're just for me, really. They're just
but as a reader,
but then, it's always fun if someone does pick it up.
But even as a reader, it's quite nice to sort of get a hint of something there that you can, as you're going along.
So I mean, with Avis, did you pick up the names there.
Oh, I can't remember. I'll have to.
Bruno is her brother, the bear. Yes. But Ralph, the fox, the wolf, Melinda. You know, so there's.
Yeah.
Yeah, Drake, the dragon.
Yes.
So they've got animal based names.
Yes.
So I had great fun because in the sequel, I have had to come up with her little sister is born.
Ah.
And so I was going through all the animal names to find something that was going to work for the baby sister.
Oh, you're so funny. So, you're clever. clever.
No, but that's all just play.
It's just play. But it makes it far more interesting and entertaining. Now, the other thing as well, this is something else that just I thought about this. So you talk about the world. So I've got here about changing vibrations, making you become in tune with other worlds. You have a lot of that in this book, don't you?
Yeah.
And that's the whole quantum physics thing, isn't it? About how everything's on a different vibration. Your sound's on one.
Well, we can't see things. We don't notice things that go very, very, very slowly.
No.
And we don't notice things that go super fast.
No.
We can't. Our senses can't pick some of those things up.
Yeah.
We don't hear sounds that dogs hear.
Yeah. Right?
Dogs can hear sounds we don't hear.
Yeah.
So there's a lot that we are limited by our senses that we have.
Yeah.
And we think we see and hear. And, like, that idea that we can't see something fast, we get that.
Yeah.
But that we also don't see something that's going slowly.
Yeah.
Like growth, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. And it's like when you watch one of those time-lapse videos of a flower growing or something, you go, wow.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes you get the temptation just to sit.
And it's like when you see somebody you haven't seen for a child who's now grown, and you go, oh my gosh, you've grown, and you go,
exactly.
I didn't see that happening.
Exactly. Let me have us a wee bit here. So about the atoms.
Oh, God.
Oh, here we go. Now, do you want to read this bit?
Oh, Lord.
Do you want to read it? Go on.
It's so interesting, because I have not read this for such a long time.
Well, this
when you are saying things to me about it, I'm going, I don't remember doing that.
Yeah, so, yeah, and this is just, let's just read this little bit here. So, about how can my atoms budge, asked Jono. And this is all the science-y stuff. I think it's brilliant.
Okay. It's not actually the atoms, Ariel explained, but the energy contained within. Visibility depends on the vibration levels of your energy. Human eyes only detect energy vibrating within a certain range. That is why you don't see all the matter within your universe. 90% of it is vibrating in the invisible ranges, like ultraviolet light. Without realizing that he was being directed by Ariel, Jono moved across his room to where an old guitar was leaning against the wall. He'd been having lessons at his old school, but hadn't used the instrument now for some months. Idly, he plucked at the strings. It was out of tune. As Jono tightened the strings, Ariel continued the explanation. Light waves are like sound waves. When you pluck a string on the guitar, you hear a note. By plucking the string harder or softer, you can change the vibration and make the note a different tone. Colours work in similar ways. By changing my vibrations minutely, I can create different colours and images. By vibrating at a level equal to the ends of the light spectrum, I can become invisible. Ariel demonstrated this and vanished altogether. Jono put down the guitar and looked at his wrist where Ariel had been. He reached his other hand and felt Ariel's dry texture as the starfish came back within his range of vision. So, Jono said, are there other things around that I can't see?
Isn't that awesome? I love
that. I think that's very cool. Did I write that? Okay.
You
will see that invisibility thing
comes up
has
again.
Come in Avis and the dragon.
Yes.
With her dragon.
Mm.
Because he is able to vibrate and change, shimmer the colours.
Yeah.
Do I want to be invisible? Or do I feel I've been? I don't know.
And I think everybody has that desire at a time, don't they? Where you are someone, you think, gee, for a minute, I just wish I could be invisible or be the fly on the wall, you know?
Maybe.
You know, or just go somewhere else. And, you know, and the thing I loved about that, in that particular passage, clearly, why it's so funny that we were talking about it, and that's the one I had marked. To me, it's just telling a reader, a young person on, you know, where this is sort of, you know, that was your sort of your aimed audience, I suppose, anything is possible.
Mm.
If you change you can change. You know, things don't have to remain as they are. Like, the underlying sort of message here is huge. It's actually a really big idea, huge concept, isn't it?
I would say there are some pretty big ideas in there around about who you are as a...
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's for those 11, 12-year-olds.
Yeah.
When they're trying to figure out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who am I?
Yeah, exactly. Who am I?
And who am I separate from my parents, which comes up through all my stories.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Making their own path in the world, you know, and making their own decisions. The other thing that I want to comment on about this book is I loved the cover.
So the cover was part of a competition that was run at an arts, another competition. I had no choice on that.
Wow.
And it was run, and I don't know if it actually indicates anywhere in the book, the cover illustration. I can't spot it. So this was somebody at Unitech or at the arts something art school up in Auckland.
They must be here mentioned somewhere. I'll have a look.
Yeah. And they sent me like their three finalists, which did make me laugh because one of them actually had a spaceship on the cover. And you will know there's no spaceship anywhere. It's alien, but it's not alien space alien. It's another universe alien.
Yeah.
And this one I just am delighted by, because when if you hold it up and read it, you've got the eye face. Winking, you've got the eye winking, and you've got this eye with the starfish, and which is so crucial to the story.
It is.
Because that's that idea, and I'm trying to think of what it is, when you see that light in your eye, when you look at a light,
and
you close your eyes,
and it stays.
And it stays in there, because that's how he first sees.
Yeah.
But just the flashlight. And then the little sea creatures that flicker.
Oh, I hadn't picked that up on this cover.
No.
Oh, well, maybe
because it's got the cover, because it's got the
plastic. Let's have a look at yours.
So it's very grubby, that one. So the one thing about a white cover is that when it's well read, it is grubby.
Brilliant. But the other thing I love, and I want to mention this, is so often people don't think enough about the cover. And the one thing I loved about this is it's eye-catching with the eye. It is eye-catching. But even on the spine of it, when it's like that on the shelf, you see the star.
You've got the starfish.
The starfish, you know, jumps out at you, which is really good rather than just simply text. But I thought that was a great cover. Oh, it's really nice knowing about about the competition that led to that. Now, whoever did a great job. We'll try and find out who it was.
I'm missing the front bit of my book, so I'm not sure.
Awesome. Okay, so that's mind over matter. Oh, I love digging into these.
Oh, well, that's lovely.
Such
because
fun.
I haven't looked at it. I haven't read it for such a long time, and I did love it.
Yeah.
So much at the time.
And it is a sophisticated book, I reckon.
Okay.
And it's interesting that it was going to be two and you've got a third. I think you need to get on and do that third one.
We can put some other projects aside. Yeah. But it is there, yeah.
Brilliant. Now, so the next one.
Heather's first book, Mind Over Matter, a novel for 9 to 12-year-olds, won the Tom Fitzgibbon's Unpublished Manuscript Award and was published in 2005 by Scholastic. It also went on to be included in the Storyline's Notable Books Award. Thank you for listening to The Author's Tale. I do hope you've enjoyed part one of Heather's tale. Join me next time for part two, where we discuss Avis and the Promise of Dragons, amongst other things. The Author's Tale, brought to you by Edition Audiobooks, working with you to bring your book to life. EditionAudiobooks.com.